on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
What the land spoke to him, what the language spoke to him, what the old stories spoke to him, was a way of understanding the indwelling sacredness of everything. And drawing on the stories of Mananon, he called this Silver Branch Vision. And he spoke about how when you encounter Mananon and when you engage Silver Branch Vision, you learn that being human is a habit that can be broken. And you might go for a while to be a seal at sea, or to be a hawk soaring above the cliff, or to be a red deer running through the forest. And then after a while, you'll come back to being human, because you'll be lonely for your human self, but you'll come back carrying all that understanding. And he said that when you engage Silver Branch Vision, then to learn to speak is to learn to say that our river has its source in the well in the other world, and that everything we might say about the hills and about the stars might be a way of saying there are nine hazels in the other world that grow over the well in the other world where our river has its source. And the other world is always close at hand.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by herbalist and author Sean O'Donohue to discuss his book, The Silver Branch in the Other World, Forest Magic with Plant and Fungi Allies. Sean discusses animism, deep ecology, and human connections with nature and tradition, the influence of plant medicines, and the balance between commercialization and genuine engagement with plant allies, and the transformative power of magic. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Sean Padraig O'Donohue is a clinical herbalist, writer, and teacher who weaves together the insights of traditional Western herbalism and contemporary science. A columnist for Plant Healer magazine and founder of the Other World Well Hedge School, he joins me today to discuss his book, The Silver Thread in the Other World, Forest Magic with Plant and Fungi Allies. Sean, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. So grateful to be here with you.
Well, I am happy that you're here with me today. I think we will have a lot to talk about. I have enjoyed reading The Silver Branch and The Other World, and I think that that may actually be the best place to start, is with the title, and ask you, what do you mean? What is The Silver Branch?
Wonderful question. So in the Irish tradition, one of the oldest of the gods, as we refer to them in English, it's complicated when we take that later Germanic word and apply it to cultures that it doesn't really fully align with, but we'll use it for the purpose of simplicity. One of the oldest of the Irish gods is Mananon Mac Liar, the son of the great sea of being. And he came long before the Tuatha Dé, who were the shining ones, the people who people think of as the fairy people, who were the ones who had gone to the north to learn the rune, to learn the mystery, and then returned riding the black north wind. And when they came to Ireland once again and set foot on that soil, they brought with them the songs that could call the flowers to blooming, that could call and disperse the storms, and that could change the directions of the wind. And they knew themselves the ways of shape-shifting and the ways of remembering from one body to the next who they were. But when Bronze Age people came from across the water, sailing up from Galicia in Spain, and took to the land, they understood that what was coming was too cruel for their way of being, and that there was something fundamental to the world that they needed to take with them and depart. And so Mananon took them all to Chiton Baroga, the great womb of the earth, That's also an ancient tomb at the mouth of the Boyne River, the river that mirrors the Milky Way. And he divided among them all the deep places, the depths of the sea and the depths of the wells and the depths of the lakes, and all of the ancient burial places, all of the stone chambers, all of the caves. And into them they went and departed. And he obscured their departure by seeing up a mist that would make the place where they went invisible unless they wanted it to be seen. And Mononon himself went across the Western Sea to the Island of Apples. But he saw also that there were times when that kind of vision that the Tuatha Dé had held would be required by this world. And so to kings and poets and healers, sometimes he would come, and sometimes women from his land would come, carrying with them a silver branch that had at once the blossoms and the fruit of the apple upon it. And when the silver branch was shaken, you could hear the song of creation being sung. And when you grasped the silver branch, you could look into the well in the other world where all our waters have their source. And so the 20th century, late 20th century Irish animist philosopher John Moriarty, who came from, grew up in a farming community in Kerry, not far from where my ancestors are from, went to university, went across the water, became a professor in Manitoba, teaching literature and philosophy, and then discovered that everything he was teaching was preparing people for a culture he wanted no part of. And so he began listening to the First Nations people in Manitoba, and listening to them, he understood that he needed to go back to Ireland and recover his own animist tradition. And what he encountered, what the land spoke to him, what the language spoke to him, what the old stories spoke to him, was a way of understanding the indwelling sacredness of everything. And drawing on the stories of Mananon, he called this silver branch vision. And he spoke about how when you encounter Mananon and when you engage silver branch vision, you learn that being human is a habit that can be broken. You might go for a while to be a seal at sea, or to be a hawk soaring above the cliff, or to be a red deer running through the forest. And then after a while, you'll come back to being human because you'll be lonely for your human self, but you'll come back carrying all that understanding. And he said that when you engage silver branch vision, then to learn to speak is to learn to say that our river has its source in the well in the other world, and that everything we might say about the hills and about the stars might be a way of saying there are nine hazels in the other world that grow over the well in the other world where our river has its source. And the other world is always close at hand. Moriarty would say this world and the other world are part of the one great world. And, up until a generation ago, really, in Ireland, there were still places where people would have the understanding, and this may even still be true in parts of the Gaeltacht, parts of the regions where Irish is still the first language, where people would have the understanding that certain places at certain times of year, you might be walking through this world and then cross into the other world without noticing until the vision is upon you. And then, depending on your luck and your etiquette, you might or might not come right back.
Okay, wonderful. That was quite beautiful. Thank you for that. I've got a couple of questions, but I also just wanted to comment on I'm gonna stumble the pronunciation, Moriarty. I'm probably not saying that right, but his observation that he couldn't teach anymore. I feel that, and I felt that when you said it, and that's the way I've often expressed it, because I've spent the past 20 years as a college professor, and a lot of the schools, their focus is on success. student
Yeah, yeah.
success. And I started questioning, well, what do we mean by success? And what it came to me was that I'm just training these people to take part in an ecocidal system.
Yeah.
And this is not an adequate education. This is not what education ought to be. It needs to be something else. So.
It calls to mind a story from early Quaker history when William Penn made his conversion and he went to George Fox and asked him about the ceremonial sword that he was wearing as a knight of the realm and whether he should get rid of it or not. And George Fox just said to him, "Wear it as long as you can." And the next day, the sword was gone.
But I do think that it's we're in the situation where I think humans we've forgotten so much, and it seems like that mist that the I'm going to refer to them, we can call them the fae. I think they're the same as the she. That mist is also kind of a mist of forgetting. And we need to remember. We need to remember well our ancestors and our connections to the land. So, with that said, I want to ask you just to be sure, and this is the college professor in me. I always like to be clear about terms and terminology. And I know I shouldn't assume that people watching or listening have a familiarity with some of these. So, what I would like you to maybe explain a little bit more in depth, you mentioned Irish animism. And what do you mean by animism?
Yeah. Well, it's always funny to put the ism on the end of it because ism suggests ideology. And there is an ideological animism that's emergent right now. And I'm going to be curious to see where it goes. And, we can certainly see it in other eras. We can see it in the deep ecology movement of the 1980s. We can see it in the Transcendentalists. This beginning to try to take the tools of Western philosophy and use them to think our way back into relation, which is certainly a worthy endeavor, and there are some great insights coming through that. But animism is far deeper than thought and belief. It is a direct experience of the world as alive. I always think about how Terence McKenna said, "The world is alive and is always speaking to you, and this is not a metaphor." And how many people I've watched try to figure out what the metaphor in that is. And it's that no, our own bodies, our biological systems, nested within biological systems that emerged in direct relation with plants and animals and fungi, and all of our senses are attuned to those subtle signals that come from other beings. And so it actually always has been a direct conversation. And, our rationalist minds began to say, well, how can that possibly be? How can that occur between species? And to go with that, well, we can take a look at the observations taken over many decades from watching the interactions between wolves and moose on Isle Royale in Michigan, filmed on wildlife cameras with no humans present. And that in that meeting between the wolf and the moose, there is some sort of exchange in which the decision is made about whether the moose is ready to die, is going to offer itself up then and there, whether the moose is saying, "Not today," and then the wolves will walk away, or whether the moose is saying, "Give chase and let's see."
Wonderful. I'm probably part of that school of the ideological animism, but it seems to me that part of it, and I think this is a crucial part of your book, is not necessarily thinking through or philosophizing about animism, but developing a relationship, developing a relationship with the plants, with the land. And it seems that once we do that, we become more fully human. We become more fully ourselves.
Absolutely. And we also discover that being human means something very different than our culture has told us it
Right.
means.
Yeah. So what does being human mean?
I'm not sure I know the answer yet. I feel like I'm still in the process of coming into full incarnation in this body.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you write a little bit about different selves. There's the human self, the animal self, and the God self. And maybe partly becoming human is, I don't know if it's a conjunction of those three selves. It seems like there may be a little bit more involved in it as well.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. So yeah, that understanding of the three selves comes from my teacher's teacher, Victor Anderson, and he saw this recurring in many traditions, although he was most influenced by Hawaiian tradition and his understanding of it. And so that animal self is the part of us that feels sensation and emotion and rhythm. And that human self is the part that conceptualizes and speaks and creates representation. And that divine self or God self is the part of us that knows our own infinity. And absolutely, the work of a life is goes into alignment. It's interesting. So, like, human self, animal self, and divine self weren't necessarily the terms that Victor used. He more often used either Yoruba or Hawaiian terms to refer to them. And so it's like we've had this idea, we have all these ideas about what makes humans distinct from other beings. And all these ideas keep unraveling. So we had the report this week about the phonetics of sperm whale language and the fact that it seems to be constructed out of phonetic elements in the same way that human language is. And so, what does that suggest about the way that shapes the consciousness of a sperm whale? And then there was the study a few years ago about the signaling within the mycelial network of a certain kind of mushroom. And it was funny to watch because a lot of people in the linguistics world got very, very upset by the assertion that this represented language because they're like, well, it's not human language. Human language is different in this way and different in that. But what if our language actually is a variation on those signaling forums? And maybe those are actually variations on the quorum sensing of bacteria. So, yeah, we have these ideas about these capacities and qualities making us human. And like we can only be special if we're the only ones who can do this. But what if it is just being in the specific biology of Homo sapiens, having the skin that we have, having the eyes that we have, having the lungs that we have and the hearts that we have, and all of our organs and all of our tissues that makes us human, rather than, oh, here's this thing we can do that other beings can't do.
Yeah, I see that a lot, especially in the classroom. And I always try to correct students because the phrase you often hear is humans and animals. And I always say, but humans are animals, you know? And it seems that what we need is a nice dose of humility, you know, to recognize that we aren't that unique, that, you know, other animals speak, you know, communicate. But even more than that, plants do too.
And we wouldn't say that a cedar or a birch are more tree than the other,
Right.
or that because an oak is different from a cedar or a birch, it is the special tree.
Yeah.
And each does have its specialness, but that has to do with its expression of its own nature, not with anything comparative.
Right. One of the questions that I did have for you, like I said, I usually try not to have a list of questions, but I do usually have a couple of questions. But this is kind of along the same lines of what we were speaking about. And I'm kind of shifting just a little bit, and we'll probably kind of go back. The coffee hasn't quite kicked in, so all apologies to the listeners. But I think it's the last section of the book. You begin with a question. What does it mean to call a plant an ally? And I wanted to ask you, well, what does it mean to call a plant an ally?
It requires, to begin with, a reciprocal relationship. You and the plant need to come to know each other over time and build a trust. One of the things my late friend and teacher, Stephen Buhner, would talk about is the tremendous importance of keeping your words with the plants and honoring your agreements, because that's what builds relationship over time. And when you've built that deep relationship over time, there becomes a greater ability to call on each other for help when necessary. And even that ability where if you can't get to that plant and that plant is far away, in the same way that, if you were trying to reach a friend and because you knew that their insight would be really useful, but it was 3 in the morning where they were and you weren't going to call them and wake them up, you could sink into your felt experience of talking with that friend and with who that friend is and begin to get a sense of what they might say in that situation. That would be something different than simply logically trying to imagine what they would say. It is tapping into that learned felt presence. And so allyship with a plant requires that learned felt presence, which is mutual because they are having an experience of you as well, and with the way that you are showing up when you show up with them. Would that actually, at a biological level, changes their chemistry? It's funny, like we have this, when I used to teach phytochemistry, I would talk about the useful fictions and the not so useful fictions that are required to have a conversation about it at all. And one of the fictions is we say that, well, mugwort has this amount of thujone in it. It's like, does it really? It's like, that would be like saying a human has this amount of cortisol in them. And with and that would be some net average, but really you'd have to look at the human, the particular human in the particular place at the particular time in the particular circumstance, and there would be varying amounts of cortisol according to their experience. And the same is true of plant constituents. Their chemistries are constantly changing in response to everything they're experiencing. And when we are part of what they're experiencing, their chemistries are changing in response to us, and our chemistries are changing in response to theirs. And this is especially true of the aromatic compounds. So our pheromones and their suite of monoterpenes and sesquiterpenes and phenols and light alkaloids that can be easily aerosolized that exist for the purpose of signaling each other and carrying information. And this is one of those areas where understanding a little bit has actually diminished a broader understanding. So it's like with the emergence of the cannabis industry, there's a lot more awareness of monoterpenes. And people will talk about, well, this monoterpene does this, and this strain has this amount of this monoterpene in it. And it's like, yes, the lemony smell comes from limonene, and the piney smell comes from pinene. But the level of limonene, the level of pinene, even in the exact same plant from one moment to the next, will be different. And it will be together with a whole suite of other molecules that are there in smaller concentrations, but are just as important to the message. And so, even at that material level, we can see the way in which the conversation changes according to how we're both showing up.
Yeah, I think that cannabis is actually a very good way of entering into this question of developing a relationship with plants. But I also see a little bit of a problem in the sense that now so many people, they're not even getting plant. They're getting these like little cartridges that have been processed that have the active ingredients within it. And it's like, but that's not a relationship with the plant. And I wonder how many people actually stop and instead of utilizing the plant to stop pain or to help with anxiety or just to get high. How many of them actually engage with the plant and recognize that the experience they are having is, and I don't know the language to use here, that maybe it is tapping into, in a way, a plant consciousness?
Yes. And yeah, there are multiple places to go with this, including what does it feel like to a cannabis plant to be growing in a warehouse under electric lights? But, of course, I don't want to go back to the world of criminalization. But I think about how naive my younger self was in expecting certain cultural shifts to come with legalization. Well, cultural shifts did come, but they came into the world of people engaging with cannabis. And I think about the growers who I knew in the years before cannabis became legal, mostly had very deep and very personal relationships with their individual plants. And I do still know growers like that, but I feel like it's not that the, it's also not that the commercial aspect of it wasn't there when it was a black market. But with the acceleration of cannabis technology, there has been more and more focus, yield and result, and less focus on relationship. And so that's changing the plant, and that's changing the people who are growing it. It's also changing the people who are going, because you're reading on a label how much THC and how much CBD, and not really thinking about this whole being you're interacting with. And then there are the complexities of the being herself, which is a very shifting understanding for me. It's even shifted since I wrote the book. So when we look at the earliest use of cannabis, it was in funeral rites. And there is this sense across time, and I've had the experiential sense, and I think I may have spoken about this in the book some. I forget what I've written down and what I've said elsewhere, but especially when I was doing trimming work for people around close to Samhain and up late at night and early in the morning in Western Maine, and feeling like, yes, absolutely, the spirits of the dead are a little bit closer. And that can be really profound and really beautiful. But when we don't take their reality seriously, and sometimes even when we do and are just sloppy, we can be not so careful about who it is and what it is that we're opening up to. And so recently, I think cannabis will always be an important ally for me in making some of those communications and some of those connections, and also in connecting with living people in certain contexts and with other beings in certain contexts. So having a little bit of cannabis and kayaking out on a cove and engaging with the loons at twilight can be a wonderful and profound thing. But for a long time for me, as a neurodivergent person, cannabis was also the plant that I was using to modulate my transition between being out in the culture and coming back in. And what I've been discovering is Well, that did smooth the transition for me. It also probably meant that before I sort of washed off and shook off everything I was taking in out there at Walmart, where being a rural person, I have to go occasionally. It's
Yeah.
Walmart or Amazon for certain things. And before really like clearing what had was sticking to me, opening myself up wider, and then letting it come in deeper and stick more.
Yeah. Yeah. A friend of mine told me about a year ago that she finally understood something that I had said in regards to cannabis. And apparently, what I had told her was that you have to learn how to work with the plant. And she essentially said, I get it now. I get it now. And I think that so often, though, people are not. You know, I one of my concerns is people using cannabis to numb themselves, and I don't think that that is, I don't think that that's what cannabis wants. I don't think cannabis wants to be a numbing agent. I think cannabis wants to be a healing agent. And I find it interesting that plant medicine itself is becoming so much more prominent in our culture, you know, psilocybin mushrooms. And you do write a little bit about psilocybin. You know, they are now legal in Colorado. But I have also seen people coming out with psilocybin gummies and ayahuasca. And I think ayahuasca is a potent, potent plant medicine and a plant ally. But I think it has to be done right. And I don't think it's by itself, but I've even seen now people selling online ayahuasca and it's just the vine. And I'm like, well, you're not going to get the, you know, what you need. But they're like, oh yeah, you can microdose ayahuasca now. And it's like, yeah, can you really? And I wonder what grandmother ayahuasca is going to have to say about all that. I wonder what the plant spirits are going to have to say about how we're using them rather than, because it seems to me there's a distinct difference between using and developing a relationship and using the plants as an ally.
Well, and I also think we're in a shifting reality. I mean, we're always in a shifting reality, but we're in a time of some really profound shifts. And one of those elements is when we speak about psilocybin and ayahuasca and the other serotonergic medicines, a big part of what they're doing is opening us and attuning us to the flow of intelligence in a larger nonlinear system. And so, like, ancestrally, this would have been occurring in a forest or a field or a desert. And that would be the complex living system you'd be being drawn into attunement with. And while, yes, absolutely, your intention was important there, there was some degree to which that larger mind was going to pull you with. And then we can think about even in the revival of these compounds in the 60s and 70s. We can think about, okay, so you're with the Grateful Dead. Here you have some technicians of the sacred who understand how to tap into what's flowing through the crowd and create the music, co-create the music with the crowd in a way that's going to shape meaning and shape experience. And so the people within the crowd are attuning to each other and to the musicians and to the music. And that's the nonlinear system you begin to attune to. And so then I began thinking about what I call the Elon Musk problems. And of course, I don't know Elon Musk. And so this is my fictional person named Elon Musk. But I got very confused because being autistic like me, Elon Musk has elevated levels of serotonin in his brain. And he also is someone who talks quite openly about his love of psychedelics. But I don't see from his outward behavior a lot of evidence of connecting with and honoring the sacredness and intelligence that's indwelling in all of life. And so I started thinking about it and I thought, oh, well, we are actually at a moment in history where we have developed entirely human-made systems that are large enough to be self-organizing in complex ways. And I'm not just talking about AI here. I mean, we have a lot of conversation about AI, but even before AI, the internet itself operated in that way. And even apart from the internet, global markets operate in that way. And so I've wondered, is Elon Musk empathizing with the global markets and feeling the flow of money? And that brings us to another significant problem here, which is the privatization of control of set and settings. And if we're going to be having human institutions, even well-intentioned human institutions, clinic, whether they be clinics or churches or retreat centers, putting a strong human structure onto the set and setting that people are engaging, that's going to change the experience quite profoundly. And we keep talking about how to make this safe. My late friend Stephen Buer said to me in a letter in his last year, a whole lot of people are going to be very disappointed when they find out that Gaia makes no guarantees of safety. And the very reason why we go to these medicines is because what we're doing isn't working. And we need to get out of, we're seeking to get out of the mindset and the identity that we've been within. And so they are inherently transformational. And what's inherently transformational is in some ways inherently unpredictable and thus inherently not safe. And so, yes, I'm in favor of making sure people are going to be physically safe. I'm in favor of, to some degree, having people have the ability to talk with other people to process their experience. But I think that the lightest human hand is generally the best. And that from an evolutionary standpoint, these beings who are far older than us and who don't only interact with us are kind of inviting us back into that relationship. It's so interesting when we look at, so when did humans probably begin engaging more regularly with these? Well, we can look at psilocybin likes to grow on pastures. Ergot likes to grow on stored grain. And so I wonder, I think there's a degree to which certainly these organisms were here long before agriculture and long before humans. But once large-scale agriculture that changed landscapes began, I imagine that there probably was a little bit more calling from those beings towards humans, saying, "Hey, come be with me a little while and remember where you came from and remember the implications of what you're doing."
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that. And it kind of counters a little bit of what I was thinking, because initially, as you were speaking, in regards to sort of the uncertainty that's inherent in the experience, I was thinking, ah, wildness. There has to be a wildness. And it seems that that is also one of the messages that you have in the book, is that we need to, be humans, we need to be a little bit more wild. But if these were kind of coming to us in as we were developing agriculture, agriculture isn't really wild all that much. So it seems like there's this sort of in-between state between our wildness and our attempts at controlling things.
Well, when we're outside, when we don't have a culture of attempting to control things, then we don't need to be reminded how to be wild in the same way.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, obvious. But it also seems as if the plants, we have a lot of healing to do. And there was something that you quoted, and it was, I think, your teacher, Benavides, said about Victor Anderson, who you have referred to here, that he felt that what was going on was that there was this, and this is a quote, "a filthy spirit that has infected humankind with a great lie." And I have had that intuition before. And I have interviewed Paul Levy, who writes, he calls it Watiko. And that's what I had in the margin. I'm like, ah, Watiko, Watiko. And it seems as if these plants are here to, one of the things to develop a relationship and an allyship is to help get rid of that filthy spirit. And
And I want
what,
to be careful how I speak of that.
yeah.
And at the same time, I think that it wouldn't be saying too much to say there was a point, up until a certain point in human history, sacrifice was always on behalf of the entire community and on behalf of the community of all beings, and was understood to exist in a world of a cycle of death and rebirth. When people began to engage in sacrifice for individual gains, something fundamental shifted in the experience of this world, and something came through the cracks.
Okay. Well, what I was also kind of connecting is that many of these plants, and in particular, I know I can speak of ayahuasca, that there is a purging involved. And at one point, you wrote that large segments of our culture often conflate and confuse purification with purging and punishing the body. But what is at play is a removing of potential powers acting on you that hinder your work.
Yeah, that was an insight drawn from Robin Artisan, a wonderful sorcerer and spiritual ecologist who's also here in Maine, and really shifted things profoundly for me, especially as somebody who grew up Catholic and taking everything very seriously, because I'm not someone who can take a worldview, I who can take a worldview and just act as when I choose to. And so, yeah, and it's interesting, as you mentioned, purging. There is, I think, a distinction to be made between purging as punishment and invitation of release. And I love that in Native American church, when people vomit during ceremony, it's called getting well. And it's also considered a gift that's being done, that's being offered up to the entire community. But absolutely, yeah. Well, and so much of our natural health culture in North America has puritanical roots that it's not even aware of. I mean, and not just 17th century puritanical roots. We can look at, Sylvester Graham and John Kellogg in the 19th century, and their ideas of purity being about getting away from the sensations and desires of the body, and also being very tied in with anti-blackness and anti-Irishness, because those wild people were seen to be a spiritual contagion, and you got rid of the spiritual contagion, you avoided the spiritual contagion by purging and punishing yourself by evacuating your bowels as well as possible and having your food have as little flavor as possible. So, and most people don't know that. And then it will take on all kinds of other clothing. It's like, yeah, it originally emerged in a Christian framework, but you can take a westernized reading of yogic traditions or a westernized reading of Taoist traditions and very quickly begin putting some of that DNA into it and genetically modifying it. And certainly, so much of the New Age movement, with its emphasis on ascension, has gone there as well. But I also know that for a time, in reaction to that, I was just like, well, to hell with purification. And then coming across Robin's idea was actually really important to me, because true purification, removing those untoward influences, is really important. And it's important on a magical and spiritual level, I also feel like there's a degree to which old hormones and old neurotransmitters that are lingering from old experiences have a spiritual reality to them and are untoward influences on our present experience. And so purification in that sense is important, so we can simply show up and do the work of being ourselves in relation.
Yeah, I think that connects directly to one of the sentences from the book that I have here or highlighted. What we don't metabolize, we hold on to. You know, so it seems like we have to. And I was also making a connection in terms of with certain therapies, you know, integration, that metabolization is an integration.
I had a client years ago who was experiencing, as some people do, all these horrible allergies to everything. And when I was talking with her about her experience, she said, "Well, I'm like the liver for everything. I take in all the poison." And then we had the conversation about, well, actually, that's not what a liver is doing. A liver is metabolizing and move and transforming and moving everything that comes in. So let's see if we can reach towards some organisms that will do that. And in that particular case, I reached toward the reishi mushroom, which is sending its mycelium through the wood of a dead or dying tree. And so that wood is all of the encoded memory of the life of that tree, which, even our most reductionist science can see when we look at nature of tree rings. And it's be and then the mycelium is growing through that. It's metabolizing that to produce the fruiting body that is making something new out of what was, and then releases the golden spores onto the wind that carry that memory in a changed form to somewhere else.
You just mentioned something kind of briefly, and it was another one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and that was magic. And this is in the subtitle of the book, Forced Magic. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak to what you mean by magic and what this forest magic looks like.
Absolutely. And so I don't think there's anyone talking about magic in our culture post Crowley, whether or not they've read him, who hasn't been influenced in some way by his definition of magic as the art and science of creating change and conformity with will. And I think that's true as far as it goes. And then the question becomes, whose will? And so, any of us who grew up Christian, and probably even many people who didn't, because we're growing up in a Christianized culture, have that concept of thy will be done, of I'm making this prayer, but who am I to be saying anything anyway? Hey, you take care of this. Then there is the inversion of that, where we say, my will be done. And that doesn't always turn out much better. First of all, I think that we tend to de-emphasize the degree to which enculturation of experience and interaction have shaped our individual wills and our individual sense of identity. And secondly, that's when it's happening from a disconnected place, we lack the real understanding of what's being called in. But if we go to our will be done, then it becomes a collaborative process. And in that collaborative process, the intention that each being taking part in the process holds changes, and each being is bringing their own individual intention and their own individual will that's been shaped by their experience. And so when it's our will as a group of humans, there is a more greater diversity of human experience and human possibility that becomes called in. when it's our will with other than human beings called into the process with plants and fungi and animals and stones and water and ecosystems, then it become the possibilities expand because they're no longer shaped exclusively by human cultural experience. And a deeper kind of transformation can occur, but that does require a willingness to let go of the sense of the centrality and superiority of our own experience and intentions.
Yeah. It seems like it's a different, I mean, it obviously is a different idea of how most people think about magic, because I think so much of magic in terms of the practice is often to get something, to have an achievable end. And if I understand where you're coming from, your approach is that it's more of a sense of it's a transformation of self where you are interconnected. So I've got a couple of lines here from the book, and you were addressing these. One was we need to bring our own wills into cooperation with other than human wills, but also it's this sort of being, I think, in the life force. You refer to the other world well, and you have this analogy of the life force flowing like a salmon that's swimming. And you follow this up by saying, you know, you understand a person's health is bound up with the health of the forest, the health of the waters, the health of the land. And I would also probably add to that the non-human animals and non-human consciousnesses, if you will. And it seems that that's where magic resides, is in that other world well of interconnection with all things. Am I understanding properly?
Absolutely. Yeah. And yes, there's a change to our self in that experience. It's actually a change in every self in that experience, because nothing. If nothing is separate, then nothing is separate. And then a change in us does change everything. And the clearer and more coherent we are in engaging that, the stronger the signal and the stronger its impact will be. And there's where the importance of purification comes in and the importance of focus. But another definition of magic that I love and actually much prefer to Crowley's, although Crowley's is useful for engaging that exercise and asking about, okay, whose will
Right.
and what nature is my friend Caroline Casey says magic is the willingness to cooperate with everything.
Yeah, I like that. And it shifts, you know, this idea of performing magic to get something. And I do have a couple more questions for you. I know we're kind of getting close here to the end, but I find it interesting the you've got this school, the Otherworld Well Hedge School, and it seems as if there's something very pagan about what you're doing, but you don't seem to be attached to a like a specific school, if that's, you know, and I don't think that school is necessarily the right terminology here. Maybe the way to express this is maybe pagan in a broad sense. And I'm wondering if that's correct. And if you are talking about a kind of a pagan path here, what does that mean to you? Because that's always one of the questions I'm asking, you know, well, what does that even mean?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I am within a tradition because Cornelia, as my teacher, brought me into a tradition. There was a tradition that Victor and Cora, as her teachers, brought her into. And that does have a very particular approach, and it's called the fairy tradition. However, it's one of those interesting things because Victor worked with each person according to who they were in order to help their emergence. And so there's not a clear set of doctrines or practices in a way that a religious sect would have. But there is that lineage, there is that flow that's important. And what's important about lineage to me is that it's more than a set of words, it's more than a set of practices. It is a way of embodied being that passes from one person to another through heartbeat and breath and presence,
Okay.
as well as through shared practice. Being the particular person who I am, and having my Irish ancestors be the loudest among my ancestors, and also living in Western Maine, where the granite that we have here in the land, and the mountains, which are the northern stretch of the Appalachians, stretch across the water and become the same as the mountains and hills of Ireland, and then dip under the water again and become the mountains of Snowdonia and Wales, and become the Scottish Highlands, and become even some of the Scandinavian mountains. So there's something about being along that particular that particular range of mountains and that particular stone that is important in shaping things. And so that shapes my own experience. But, and I can only speak from my own lived experience, but what I'm trying to do is invite people into their own lived experience in relation with the beings who are around them, which include the beings who came before, both the beings who are where they were before and the beings who are their own ancestors. More and more lately, I've been thinking also about descendants and whether or not we have biological descendants. There are those in the future whose lives are shaped by what we do.
Right.
And we think about, in Irish culture, we think especially around Samhain of the idea that the dead are more present, and that when we're holding ritual, they're holding ritual with us. And the fire that we're sitting around and the fire that they were sitting around are deeply connected. Assuming that we make it up through this particular time, and I do think as a species we will, as a civilization we probably won't, and that's probably for the best, that somewhere in the future, there probably are people sitting, there will probably be people sitting around Samhain fires and remembering us. And if we can ask their voices to be a little bit louder, maybe they can help us remember the particular way that we got through this time.
Yeah.
And so it's calling in all of those relationships. I also used to be much more doctrinaire in my paganism, in that I was much more rejecting of anything that was touched at all by Christianity. And I still have very deep critiques of monotheism in general and very deep critiques of Christianity as we know it. And yet, spending just little bits of time in the west of Ireland and seeing the lived syncretic traditions and the ways in which the saints and also Mary are so deeply present in the landscape and are not distinct in the way that they're present in the landscape from the way that older beings are, and it's all woven together. And some of the understandings are pretty, that people are engaging in their daily prayer are pretty far outside official doctrine, especially the further you get from the center of the diocese. And even more so once you get from the English language into the Irish language, I now no longer make those sharp distinctions. And there are times that I will call on some of those beings myself, just not calling on them as a Christian.
No, I appreciate that. And there is a definite distinction between Christianity as it is lived and practiced versus the dogma and the theologies, I think. And that's important to keep in mind. There's a terminology for it that I don't remember. that I was speaking with someone who's a folklorist who used it, and I wish I could remember, but it would be perfect for it. One of the things that kind of one of the last questions I wanted to ask is in regards, you mentioned Samhain, and this was one of the most, from my perspective, one of the most pagan aspects of your work. And I imagine that, you know, the animism is part of a lot of pagan traditions, but it was the will of the year. But what was interesting is I always refer to them as the holidays in between, because you didn't have the solstices and the equinoxes in there, but it was Samhain, Imbolc, I can Beltane, and I can never pronounce Lugnasad. So I was wondering, with these holidays and the wheel of the year, how do they fit in with this picture of connection or this attempt to reconnect and with everything? How do those fit in?
To me, it has to do with the flow of life. And so, a wonderful folklorist and archaeologist and musician who I haven't had a chance to meet but have been influenced by the bits of his writing that are out there, Billy Meg Flynn from Dingle Peninsula in the west of Kerry, talks about the oldest division of the year in Irish culture is a division into two seasons, the dark and the light. And everything begins in the dark because everything begins in the dark, including our own lives being in the dark of the womb. And so when the year begins at Samhain, it is the time when life force is pouring downward. Or we could also think of it as pouring inward. We can think of it like the beginnings of life coming into the womb. And that's a completely inward time in a dark, watery place. And so if you're, we can walk around and see that happening. If you walk in a field close to Samhain, you'll see that the seeds and the fruits have fallen to the ground. You'll find that the leaves have been dying back, and what remaining life force the plant has is pouring down into its roots. And so people seeing that understood this was the time to do that as well. And so this was the time when primary focus and primary honor was given to the other world, which includes but is not limited to the world of the dead. It's also the world of those yet to be born, and it's also the inward dimension of everything. And so the year begins at Samhain with that life pouring down in. Then at Imbolc, we are halfway from Samhain until the beginning of the bride of the year. And there are different, there's disputes about the etymology, but the etymology that I find most instructive is in the belly, Imbolc. And you know, we have the concept of the quickening when the child, the stirring of the child within the womb can first be felt by the mother. And it's like, and I think of Imbolc as the quickening, the life that's sleeping within the land. And you know, in Ireland, you'll have dandelions and bluebells and other wildflowers coming up right around then. Probably it falls a little bit later here in Maine that although there are things that beginning to happen within the trees at that time, to me, I associate it with when the skunk cabbage begins melting through the ice, which is late February, early March. Whereas in Ireland, Imbolc is thought of as beginning of February. So you're still in the darkness, but you're beginning to prepare for the returning of life. And then you come to Beltane, which is when life begins pouring back into this world. And the life pouring into this world is pouring in from the other world. And so Beltane is especially associated with the blossoming of the hawthorn and the blackthorn, which have these white flowers. And so So these flowers are this blossoming forth of life. But white is the color of the dead, because white is the color the things are after blood has left our bodies. So it's that other world life coming into this world. And then we cycle to Lunasa, and the sun is still blazing bright, but the day we can feel the days are getting shorter, and the first seeds and the first fruits are ready for harvest. And so we're preparing to come back to the darkness, and then we circle back around fully again.
Yeah. It seems to me that it's part of the importance of this is to get us into the cycles, the natural cycles of things. Time is not linear. Time is cyclical, right? And that's part of the healing process, and recognizing our connections.
Well, and our concept of linear time is so connected with eschatology.
Yeah.
And the eschatology then reshapes who we think we are and what we think we're doing.
Right.
And I mean, if you believe there's an end of the world, you're going to try to work towards making it be the end that you want it to be.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you're going to approach things in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, there are so many things that we need to do to heal, it seems, and that interconnection and just being in those cycles seems a good place to start and to stop and listen to the plants. Yeah. So, Sean, let me ask you the final two questions here. What do you have coming up next? What are you working on next? And also, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I'm just beginning the work on the next book, which I'm tentatively calling Rewilding Psychedelics, because I am very concerned about the emergent psychedelic industry and about that privatization of set and setting that I've been speaking about. And I haven't heard that many voices speaking in the way that I would like to about that. So I'm going to allow my own voice to carrying echoes of other voices. And then every Sunday night, I'm teaching online through the Otherworld Hedge, well, the Otherworld Well Hedge School, and people can take part live or listen to the recordings later. And we move through a variety of themes, most herbal, some more magical, some more mythic, and a combination of whatever's calling to me to be spoken and whatever people are asking for at that particular time. And you can find out through about all that I'm doing through my website, otherworldwell.com.
Otherworldwell.com. All right. I will put a link for that in the show notes in the video descriptions, as well as links to the Silver Branch and the Other World so that people can find it a little bit more easily. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and thank you for the work that you're doing. I always applaud people who are trying to help heal the world. I think that's probably the most important work that anyone can engage in right now.
Thank you, and thank you for these conversations that you're inviting people into, both the conversations you're having with us directly on the show, and also the conversations that you're starting with those who listen and then carry it forward and engage it within themselves and with others. That's such important work. And more, there's this word in Irish, meichal, which refers to a work party. And so traditionally, you would think of it as everybody's going to get together and cut turf, everybody's going to get together and bring in the grain, etc. But more and more, I'm thinking that that meaning making is always a meihal. And
Yeah.
so, thank you for the particular meihal of meaning that you're creating here.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's hard work, but I think it is meaningful, and hopefully it's helpful to people. Hopefully it's helpful. So hopefully we'll be able to speak again
That'd be
sometime
fun.
soon. I would really enjoy that. So Sean, I'm going to thank you one last time, and until we speak again. And that's a wrap on episode 152 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. If you would like to support my work here on Rebel Spirit Radio and please support my work, then consider joining my Patreon, which has several perks for members, including early access to episodes, a book club, ad-free episodes. Trust me, I know how annoying those YouTube ads can be. There's also a private Facebook group you can get access to and the Rebel Spirit Radio Discord server. There aren't too many other members at the moment, but I'm hoping that will change and we can create a thriving community of rebel spirits. Also, please share this episode with friends, family, coworkers on social media. Help me grow my audience. And please subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that really helps and is important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it, but it's incredibly time-consuming. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. I'm planning on hosting more live streams. I've got a few other projects in the works, and I'd also like to create some educational videos as well. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to spread the good news. I'm Nick Mather. And you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.